I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee, and we do have a quorum present, so if we have a motion, Representative Holberg, would you like to move the minutes? I know you were here early. Okay, Representative Holberg moves approval of the minutes for February 25th. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. By way of announcement, we're going to have this morning's hearing will be on the forecast, and we've asked MMB to give us a review. It's been well publicized over the weekend, but after the review, this will be an opportunity if there's any questions that members may have as we move forward. After we hear from MMB, we will recess until after session. And originally, we had posted it 15 minutes after session. Representative Holberg would like to have an opportunity for the Republican caucus to gather after the session. So we will we delayed the time then 1 hour, I think, is what we announced or mentioned for you. So. If you want to tell your folks where to meet or whatever.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we appreciate, given the late notice on Friday, having the opportunity to caucus after session in the Republican Ways and Means will caucus in room 272 immediately following session.
Okay. And with that, we'll just begin with the MMB presentation. And which one of you is going to be going for? Will you be first, Commissioner?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. With me for the presentation today, to my right, is State Budget Director Margaret Kelly, and to my left, State Economist Dr. Laura Kalambakidis. We're happy to give you a more thorough briefing about the forecast that was released just on Friday, answer any questions that you might have about it, and give you any additional information that you might be interested in. We're going to work off of the slides that I believe everyone has. It's a document that was used for the caucus briefings on Friday, as well as the press conference, and gives you sort of the key messages out of this. There's a more detailed book that includes 77 pages of more details and explanation, charts and graphs. If you want to get into it further, and I really do commend that for your examination. The forecast in general really brings you some good news. We are finding that the anticipated surplus that we had projected last November not only is confirmed, but has grown a little bit. And it's really a fairly straightforward set of reasons. It's really directly tied to some modest changes in the U.S. national economy, diminished level of uncertainty over federal fiscal policy, all driving really state revenues that go forward. With those factors together, we see that our revenue picture improves slightly, leading us to a projected balance of $1.233 billion for the current budget biennium, and also improving the outlook for the next biennium by pretty much the same amount of around $400 million. The anticipation of this forecast was that it was going to be good, and it totally makes sense because the last couple of revenue updates that we have provided you since the November forecast were positive. As of the February 10th revenue update, the state was already at $255 million in collections above and beyond what we had anticipated in November. So this is really sort of following that and sort of confirming the factors that were underlying that November forecast. If we look at the next page, we'll show you the big numbers and go into that a little bit more. What you see is the beginning balance from the previous biennium coming in. That's really the gathering of both the budget reserve / rainy day fund, as well as the cash flow account, some appropriations that are carried forward from 2013, to be spent in 2014, plus a larger amount that was really part of 2013 close that was directed by the legislature to be used to start paying down or continue paying down the school shifts. As of this forecast, those shifts are completely off the books. And what you're seeing in the bottom line is basically a forecast change without any intermediary changes for replenishing reserves or taking back school shifts. Of the changes that you see in this forecast, you'll see $366 million of them are on the revenue side, added to by a $48 million change on the spending side and negated only by a $6 million change in the stadium reserve. The revenues are largely driven on by tax revenues changes, but still in terms of percentage changes, it's about 1%. Spending changes is a minuscule 0.1% change, and the stadium reserve is really an adjustment due to the lower than anticipated debt service for the stadium, and that's entirely drawn from our conclusion that we sold the bonds and we got slightly better rates than we had been holding in the November forecast. That all adds together to a change of $408 million in this forecast, leaving us with a $1.233 billion anticipated surplus for this period. I should say that I always use the word anticipated or try to use that as much as possible. There are still uncertainties in this, and you know we're still getting our way into this budget period. Certainly, when you look into the out years, you have even more uncertainty. And that is something that I think you all know, that these numbers will move, continue to move. But the underlying message that you should hear is that the state's economy is doing quite well, that we are in much more solid budget shape than we've been in recent years, and that as a result we have some flexibility to both handle some of those risks and make public policy looking forward with a longer term horizon. It's a very good place to be. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Kalambakidis to walk through the next couple of charts. She'll introduce you to some of the U.S. economic factors as well as the revenues that were included in this forecast.
Hey,
Commissioner, I'm assuming, although I'm open to either approach, that you would prefer to do the presentation and then take questions, or
sure.
That work best for you?
Okay.
Go right ahead.
I did. I'm on the list.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next slide in your handout is the slide, the bar chart that describes the U.S. economic outlook for real GDP. What you have is Global Insights forecast for real GDP for 2013 to 2017. The dark bars are their current forecast, their February forecast, and the light bars are their November forecast, which is the forecast that was in place at the time that we prepared our November revenue forecast. So there are two significant changes in the U.S. economy since our November forecast. And the first is that there was positive momentum at the end of 2013. So that contributed to this change in the U.S. economic outlook. So what you can see from the bar chart and Global Insights forecast is that in each year, except 2017, their forecast improved a bit from November to February. And that part of that is because of this boost or this momentum that we saw at the end of last year. The economy ended 2013 on a positive note. We had a solid 4.1% GDP growth in the third quarter of 2013. And then that was followed by what is now a downward revised 2.4% growth in the fourth quarter of 2013. And momentum underlying that that change has set the stage for a stronger 2014. What else you can see from the Global Insight graph is that even in November, Global Insight was expecting acceleration in calendar year 2014. So Global Insight was expecting growth to speed up in 2014. But what has happened since is that that's been that's slightly higher now. So the forecast for real GDP growth accelerates from 1.9% in 13 to 2.7% in 14 and 3.3% in 15. The other issue or the other aspect of the U.S. economy that has changed or been significant since our last forecast is that fiscal policy uncertainty, as the commissioner mentioned, federal fiscal policy uncertainty, and the effect of fiscal tightening that slowed growth in 2013 have receded as federal policymakers have peacefully resolved a number of fiscal policy deadlines. The Congress passed the Bipartisan Budget Act. They ended the 16-day government shutdown. We've had a clean increase in the debt ceiling. There's some relief from the sequester. Together, all of these moves eliminate the threat of another government shutdown this year. Now, this matters because policy uncertainty has an effect, can have measurable effects on the economy. And the chart at the top of page 3 of the handout, this mountain range chart, is one measure of that policy uncertainty developed by some economists from Stanford and the University of Chicago. And so they created this index of policy uncertainty that reaches peaks at times when these debates occur, when these crises occur. So you can see some of the peaks, including the financial crisis in 2008, the August 2011 debt ceiling dispute. And most recently, at the far right hand of the graph, you can see the recent peak in October 2013 at the time of the government shutdown and the debt ceiling debate at that time. And what has happened since then, since many of these issues have been peacefully resolved, is that policy uncertainty has significantly decreased, and you can see a lower level of that index now. The reason we emphasize this, that this has been a change in the economy, is because for years we've been talking about the impact of fiscal policy uncertainty on the economy and having a negative effect on economic performance. So, as I said, policy uncertainty can have measurable effects on the economy, and one of the things that correlates with this positive policy uncertainty is consumer confidence. Business confidence as well, because business owners and households, individuals, don't want to spend money. Businesses don't want to invest or hire people when they aren't sure what's coming down the pike. So uncertainty imposes costs on them, and they reduce economic activity. So the next graph is a graph of a consumer confidence index, or a consumer sentiment index, from University of Michigan and Reuters. And what you can see is it's almost the flip side of that policy uncertainty chart, where the peaks in the policy uncertainty chart correspond to valleys or dips in consumer confidence. So if you look to the right of the chart there, the solid line is actuals, and then the dotted line is Global Insight's forecast of consumer confidence as of November, when we were preparing our November forecast, and then the dashed line is their forecast now. So you can see at the time, just prior to the government shutdown, if you look to the left of that government shutdown dip, you can see a peak. That was the summer of 2013, and consumer confidence was running high at that point. We were at seven-year highs for consumer confidence, and things were looking quite good. Then we had the government shutdown and the debt ceiling debate, and consumer confidence fell. But it did recover, and Global Insight had forecast that it would recover, but it recovered more quickly than was expected, and now the forecast going forward is for higher consumer confidence. This is something that we've been looking for, because we've had positive fundamentals in place in the economy for a while. We have had consumers have, or households have improved their balance sheets. We have employment growth in the U.S. economy has averaged nearly 180,000 net new jobs a month over the past 6 months. The impact of federal fiscal austerity from the 2013 is behind us. We think there's pent-up demand for durables, including houses and autos. Corporate profits have been high. So with these fundamentals in place and with an improvement in consumer confidence, we think that supports the forecast of the accelerated growth we expect to see in 2014. Before I get to the revenue story, I want to talk a bit about Minnesota's economy. Minnesota's economy continues to make solid gains. That was the story we were telling in November, and that's basically the same story now. Minnesota's unemployment rate ended the year at 4.6%, the lowest level since before the recession began in 2007, and a full 2 percentage points below the national rate. Non-farm employment payrolls increased. Our growth rate in non-farm employment payrolls, or jobs, our jobs growth increased from 2012 to 2013. The state added 46,000 net new jobs last year, or 1.7% growth, which is slightly higher than the U.S. Growth rate. First-time claims for jobless benefits have fallen to levels not seen in more than 10 years, so that's a positive development in the labor market. And some other leading labor market indicators are boding well for growth this year. In our forecast, Minnesota employment growth is expected to be both stronger and broader than last year. It's expected to maintain a similar pace of 1.6% growth in 2014, but then we expect it to accelerate to about 2.2% growth in 2015. And that forecast is a slight increase from over November. So that's the stronger part of the forecast. One of the things that we think has been positive about job growth in Minnesota in the last year has been that it has been across almost every major industry sector, with the exception of federal government and manufacturing. Manufacturers in Minnesota are employing fewer people. We're employing fewer people at the end of 2013 than they were the prior year, and that's of concern. We did see some positive monthly gains toward the end of 2013 in that industry, but it's definitely on our watch list. What we are expecting is that these existing fundamentals that I've talked about, consumer and business confidence, and the underlying expectations for growth, should help broaden that recovery to manufacturing, but we're definitely keeping an eye on that industry. So the next graph is our graph of income growth. The lines on this bar graph, the dark line, is the percentage annual change in adjusted gross income by Minnesota residents. So it's an income measure taken off of tax returns. And the bars are decomposing those annual percentage changes into the change attributable to wage growth and the change attributable to non-wage income. So non-wage income is, of course, business income, capital gains, interest, dividends, the things that aren't wages and salaries, and compensation for labor. A couple of things to gather from this graph. One is, first of all, the blue bars on the far right are our estimates or forecasts, and the remainders are actuals. If you look at the bar chart or the bar for 2012, you see this jump, and the largest portion of that jump is in non-wage income. So that was a year in which adjusted gross income reported by Minnesota residents grew 8.6%, and of that change, 3.6 percentage points were due to increased wages and 5 points from non-wage income, such as capital gains. And what that is that's Minnesota taxpayers' response to the federal fiscal cliff, or the anticipation of higher tax rates in 2013 at the federal level. And so an acceleration or a choice by taxpayers to realize capital gains sooner rather than later. And so we see this increase in non-wage income, and then we see the payback the following year where non-wage income growth falls below the bar. And combined with moderate wage growth, we had adjusted gross income growth of only 0.7% in 2013. Looking forward, though, looking further to the right, you can see we forecast moderate income growth going forward. That is of 5.7% in 2014 and 5.8% in 2015. The last thing I'd like you to note from this graph is if you look especially at the last six bars, the last 6 years, and you look at those dark bars, which are the percentage, the contribution of wage growth to total income growth, you can see that the wage growth is relatively steady, but the non-wage income growth is not. So the non-wage income growth changes quite a bit, illustrating that non-wage income adds volatility to the income series and consequently also adds volatility to our revenue. In addition, non-wage income, taxes on non-wage income are more often paid by estimated tax payments, whereas on wage income it's more often paid by withholding. And so taxpayers have some discretion as to when they make those payments. So having a significant portion of our income coming from non-wage income means that it makes it more difficult to forecast the tax receipts coming from those sources. Finally, let's move to revenues. The next chart is simply a table of the revenue changes that the commissioner already talked about. Higher revenues contribute $366 million to the forecast balance, and higher income and sales taxes are the source of almost all of that. Income taxes went up 1%. They had the largest dollar amount change. Sales taxes went up 1.6%, and that's over the previous forecast. The change of the income tax forecast since November is in part due to a change in information we had about tax liability in 2012, which is the base year of this forecast, and so that increased and that raised our forecast some. We also had changes to a number of income sources, income variables. There were a number of small changes. Some of them were partially offsetting, or they were partially offsetting. However, our wage forecast is slightly ahead of where it was in November. Business income, interest income, taxable Social Security benefits, our forecasts are up for those a bit as well. Another aspect of this change since November is that so far in fiscal year 2014, our collections in the income tax are ahead of where we expected them to be. So the state has collected $138 million more, in particular, in individual estimated income tax payments. So again, I mentioned those as the payments that taxpayers have some discretion about when they are paying those taxes. But most of that increase in estimated payments, we are not assuming is the result of higher than expected tax liability in 2013. Instead, we think that taxpayers are paying a larger share of their taxes sooner than perhaps they needed to, and that that's going to result in our seeing smaller final payments or larger refunds when they file their final returns or their extensions on April 15th. Expected sales tax revenue is also ahead, 1.6% more than November's estimate of that change. Some of it, $50 million or so, arises from expected growth in economic activity. There's also a significant amount of technical adjustments in the sales tax forecast. Finally, I've already touched on some of the uncertainties that remain in this forecast. I talked about non-wage income adding revenue volatility. Non-wage income, as I said, is concentrated among taxpayers who make their payments by estimated payments. It's also concentrated in higher income taxpayers, and so some of the taxpayers who are affected by the new fourth tier in the income tax. As a result, as I said, a larger share of our receipts are being collected from sources that are more volatile, and that increases the challenge in forecasting receipts. I talked about recent higher than expected tax payments that we do not assume are going to persist going forward. If we're wrong about that, then we'll see some higher than expected payments later in this year. And then finally, you've heard about some of the U.S. economic data that have come in during the winter that are have been lower than expected. There have been there were disappointing jobs numbers at the U.S. level in December and January, a slowdown in the manufacturing expansion, a slowdown in housing starts. These things, many of them have some element of impact from the harsh winter weather in them, and there is a question at the moment as we look at these come in, are they temporary, and once the weather clears, those indicators are going to reverse direction, or are they perhaps a signal that the U.S. economy is slowing down? So that's one of the risks, is that what many observers are interpreting as temporary weather-influenced factors could be, in fact, a slowdown in the U.S. economy. I'll now turn this back over to the Commissioner and to Budget Director.
Think what we'll do, we've got a couple of members that have indicated during your presentation.
Okay.
Dr. Kalamakidis. So I think we'll take those now, then, before we get to the expenditure side.
Okay.
First one was Representative Abler. And by the way, before I entertain that question, I should point out that Representative McNamara, I've learned something about him today, that he does bake cookies. I asked him if he baked those cookies that are at the end of the table himself, and he said rather than chopping wood out in the cold weather, he preferred to bake cookies. So he brought us a treat this morning. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, I should stick with wood.
Mr. Chairman, this is just kind of
Representative David.
I'm not supposed to have it, right? And it smells so good.
So
we won't tell.
I guess, yeah, that we won't tell.
Are
you
on camera?
You're on television this morning.
Yeah.
So if somebody that's monitoring you is watching the number of cookies you eat, you will be on TV. The other thing I should mention is that we have our page, Nick Harper. There he is. And Nick, could you tell us just briefly a little bit about yourself? I waited until we had more members here so they would get to know a little bit about you and who you are.
So good.
Sure. My name is Nicholas Harper. I'm originally from Iowa. I came to Gustavus Nelson College for undergrad. After that, I went to the University of Iowa College of Law. And then I loved Minnesota so much that I returned here after
put that on
in Iowa. And took this position while waiting for my to wave into the Minnesota jurisdiction.
And by the way, and I met him, I think it was the day after the Gophers beat Iowa, so it was a good time to get an introduction to a resident of Iowa. We had a certain amount of pride, at least temporarily. Okay, with that, thank you very much. And Representative Abler, I'll
get back. Oh, thanks. Just one question, and just to get another show all their surplus. I think we chose well when we got our budget commissioner. Yeah. So, it's amazing. I have a question about the just general on the the elasticity of the tax revenues. A lot of us think that some of those there's anecdotes all over the place about people who are not doing activities that we thought they would keep on doing. Can you just tell me how those are reflected and where some softness in the numbers for revenue might be, or how those are incorporated? I don't know which person to ask, but just the panel.
That sounds thanks. Like my question. We certainly, you know, we do believe that taxpayers respond to changes in taxes, and one of the things that we saw was this, as I showed you on the graph, was this change in the timing of tax payments due to the fiscal cliff, and we think that taxpayers are continuing to respond to changes in are responding by changing their timing of tax payments. And we do hear anecdotes of other responses. What we don't see at the moment in the economic data that we have now about Minnesota is a dramatic change in the economy, in employment or income, that is potentially a response to a change in taxes.
Representative Abler.
So, you're forecasting, and the mm-hmm. projections are rosy, and it's better than ever. And so, are you going to wait till something hits us on the head, or are you going to just? And there's all kinds of anecdotes, and I'm not mm-hmm. trying to make the tax debate happen here. That's tonight. Have you taken that into consideration, or are you just waiting for it to show up in some indicator?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do take into consideration what we think is going to happen in Minnesota's economy. So we have a forecast of Minnesota's economy that includes a lot of factors that we think are going to influence the economy, including some factors that influence the global economy. As I said, the primary thing that we have illustrated in terms of responses to changes in taxes are these timing changes that we think are happening now.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to badger the witness. I just think that we're underestimating the elasticity. So that's just my comment. Thank you.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You painted a really rosy scenario on many fronts. But if you go to page 65 of your complete forecast, if you compare numbers from the November forecast to the February forecast, we see drops in the amount of projected personal income. If you go to the projected annual non-farm wages, they're dropping in the February forecast versus the November forecast in 2014 through 2017. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can let us know what accounts for those drops in income projections.
Yeah. You see some drops in individual years, but cumulatively from our base year out, the wage forecast is slightly up. We did lower our forecast for wages in 2013 relative to November because in November our 2013 wage forecast was based on preliminary data from income tax withholding, and we got new data that led us to lower that forecast. In terms of non-wage income, the changes in the non-wage income forecast from November, let me also say one more thing about wages, and that is that we said in November that the wage forecast for Minnesota was faster than the U.S. average, and with this decrease in our expectations for 2013, we're still above the U.S. forecast, but that gap has closed. With regard to non-wage income, that's dominated by capital gains, and there were some changes in our expectations based on information from a preliminary sample of 2012 tax returns, which suggested that we had more acceleration, this fiscal cliff acceleration, we had more of that potentially than the U.S., and so that led us to lower our expectations for future capital gains because that money had to come from somewhere. So we think there was more shifting, again, more timing changes.
And so if, Mr. Chair, if two of those major income or major indicators of revenue are actually down, then what accounts for the additional revenue in the forecast?
Well, again, if you look over a number of years, the wage forecast is higher. So it was just that 2013. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If you look over a number of years, the wage forecast is higher overall. Business income is up. Interest income is up. There were some other elements. As I said, we got additional information about 2012 tax liability that told us that 2012 tax liability was higher than we thought it was going to be. That's our base year, so we had that increase in the base. We had changes in a number of income variables. Some of them were offsetting. Some went up, some went down. But business income went up. Wages went up a bit.
So, Mr. Chair, just to overly summarize, most of this growth is in the business income and not necessarily personal income in the state of Minnesota that contributed to the forecast.
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, business income is part of personal income because income that's accrued, individuals earn income and they earn it from businesses. In terms of the shares and the breakdown in the growth rates, and if you look at that adjusted gross income bar chart, you can see that wages, let me look at my chart. Yeah, so the growth in adjusted gross income going forward, this 5.7 in 2014, 5.8 in 2015, most of that, when we decompose that growth into wages and non-wage income, most of that is in wages.
And Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, in your calculations, did you factor any exodus of businesses and income and wealth from Minnesota as a result of the increased tax burden, the fourth tier? Does this forecast reflect any movement in that direction?
Dr. Colombo-Petis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, members of the committee, we considered a number of influences on Minnesota's economy that could possibly influence employment and income and all of the sources of income that influence revenues. And the net sum of all of that information is the result of all of that information is the forecast that you see here.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that. Mm-hmm. My question was a factor of this computation at least some loss of income to the state as a result of individuals or businesses leaving the state because of the less favorable tax climate or other reasons? In other words, was there an exodus factor mm-hmm. at all in these numbers?
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all of the information about the Minnesota economy, including the tax system in Minnesota, were considered when we constructed our forecast for Minnesota's economy.
But, Mr. Chair, I'll just try one more time. Was there any number in the computation considered for people actually leaving the state or an exodus? Was that, I mean, you say the overall, but was that a factor? Was there a negative number added into the figuring to reflect what some believe is a possibility, what others know is a reality? Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we considered the response of Minnesota taxpayers to the wide range of tax law changes that have occurred in Minnesota.
All right. Thanks.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Holberg, I'm not going to give up quite as easy. Our questions are almost exactly the same. Dr. Kalamakidis, my question is, I just happened to have been lucky enough to spend a few days in southern Florida a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. and really unfortunately walked across the street and visited with three different families that used to be residents of my community and now are South Florida residents. Mm-hmm. In the forecast for 15-16, how many more Minnesotans did you include in a forecast that are going to leave our state, like these three couples who were, let me think, an electrician, mm-hmm. she's a school teacher, one's an accountant, and his wife was an administrative assistant, the other one was a carpenter, and I don't know what his wife did. Mm-hmm. These weren't multimillionaire that arguably were in the top 2%. But we tax the snot out of a lot of things that people do in Minnesota and they don't in Florida, including non-income wages or not wage income. How many people did you include in your forecast for the next biennium? Because this year they couldn't live there 6 months and a day for the current. How many of those people did you forecast were chasing out of this state compared to the current rate?
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our forecast for demographic changes, for population changes, are included in our book. Let's see. Let's go this way. Let's see. Personal income.
The net numbers.
It's in the back in the appendix. And so we base our many of at the aspects of our Minnesota model, including housing and employment, right, and some employment numbers, are influenced by expectations for changes in population. And changes in are on page 63. So you have changes in total population and changes in numbers of households. Those are influenced by or inconsistent with forecast by the state demographer's office. And so you can see on page 63, both are expected changes in population, our expected changes in households, and our expected changes in employment. And again, all of those were informed by all of our information about Minnesota's economy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, I appreciate you're new to the process and you're actually a very talented woman. And I really give you credit for already getting the system. You've had the question asked about five times and you refuse to answer it. And I get that. That's unfortunate for Minnesotans that you won't tell us that you don't add any people to the system and assume they're going to move to Florida or Arizona or Texas. I happened to stop by. I usually don't stop by Caribou. I have a Caribou coffee cup this morning because I had a constituent who wanted me to be interviewed for a college class and ran into a ex-teacher from Hastings and a pretty graphic individual. And he said, Denny, what the blank's going on? Just talked to a buddy in Cottage Grove. He's going to become a resident of Texas. That was this morning at about 8:15. Doctor, how many people are you assuming, beyond the ones that are already moving away, are going to move away now because of the tax policy? It's my understanding you don't include it because you don't know. Your forecast assumes that we haven't chased more out. And if it does include chasing them out, how many are you anticipating that you're chasing out with the current policy? Doctor, we should put our governor on a plane to Florida and meet with some of the folks that are now Florida residents and understand what's going on. How many people are you assuming are leaving this state in the forecast, the rosy $2 billion plus forecast in 15 and 16? How many are you assuming are moving away more than the current rate of exodus? And if you don't want to answer it, you can just say, I don't want to answer it. Or I don't know, or we don't include any, or we've included X number. Because truthfully, in these numbers somewhere, you can give the answer to that question.
I think, Representative McNamara, the question that you pose is probably more appropriate to the state demographer. I don't know if you track that. I don't recall that in any forecast under any administration that that's built into the forecast. I don't know, I don't know if the commissioner cares to comment on that. You've got a little longer history than perhaps. And by the way, I should have welcomed you here this morning. This was your first time before the committee, so let's not make it too heavy an orientation for the first day before us. But, Commissioner, if you'd care to comment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand the question and concerns. Mr. Chair, it pointed out what I was going to tell you, which is that you haven't in previous forecasts also had a ad factor or a negative ad factor on demographics due to any one factor. We try to work with the state demographer's office to make sure that we're giving a consistent and extensive set of numbers. I think your question is about, well, there's some people in Florida from Minnesota, and that's absolutely true. That is a factor that the demographer's office has been bringing up to the legislature for quite some time, and it is a significant outflow in the demographer's numbers. So that has been and continues to be, I think, a concern because, as you remember, some of the presentations before this group has been population, maintaining our workforce, maintaining those numbers. That is what the basis of this forecast is built on, and there's nothing inconsistent about how this forecast was built. I understand the concerns. Dr. Colin Bakitas understands the concerns, but it isn't a particular ad factor in the revenue models that M&B brings towards you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Showalter, then if I understand, the demographers told you that people are moving away and you're not taking that into account in the future forecast. Because you've said the demographer is telling you people are moving away, but I don't hear you tell us how many you've included in moving away and that lost income, how it equates to Minnesotans. That, like the three couples I just talked about who a few years ago paid Minnesota taxes and now don't.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's not what I said. I said that we work with the demographer's office, so we build those numbers in. If there's a special analysis that you're looking for in terms of breaking down the information that the demographer provides, we can certainly work with them to get that to you. In terms of the revenue impact of inflows or outflows of people into the state, I don't know if that's within our capacity, but we can certainly talk about that with you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, I'd appreciate it if you'd get back to the committee in an answer to Representative Holberg's and my question on how many of the demographer folks that the demographer says are moving away. What's the net impact of that income to Minnesota when these folks move away? And the reality is I think we should be concerned about that. And what the effect is, because it's very significant and it's really tragic.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I certainly will do that. I would just note that even in the last couple months, I've been thinking about moving away for totally different reasons.
We're breaking all records with the weather, so In fact, I have a question a little bit later for the state economist dealing with the weather impact, but I'll hold on mine. And Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I must read totally different research and statistics than are being reflected around the table, because what's been very clear to me in all of my reading is that over and over economists say tax policy doesn't drive movement and population, as do a host of other things, including investment in education and infrastructure, as we compare ourselves to others. I think as significant as the questions being asked around here, if that is relevant to the forecast, is who's coming to this state. And my read about population statistics not long ago is that for the nation, our population has the smallest increase maybe ever, but certainly for some time. So the nation is not growing. Minnesota is. So who comes here and why? We heard our page choosing Minnesota. There is a young demographic choosing Minnesota. Why? Now, I think what they've tried to tell us is that's not necessarily the questions they ask as we do forecast, but the questions around the table seem to suggest there's only one reality. And all of my read is that the reality, in fact, is very, very different. So I apologize to the testifier, the expert testifier, who's I don't know if this is your first time here, but where credentials have been questioned, and I think we apologize for that.
Yes, this is her first time before us, and you'll be here many times into the future, I'm sure. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just throw this out to whoever wants to respond. And just in looking at the chart with the income growth, the one that's up on the screen now, and obviously we segment out the non-wage income versus wage income. And in looking at this, I mean, clearly we've fallen into a pattern since really 2001, where wage income growth, except for 1 year, 2007 was the only outlier, where wage income is up to 4%, and in many cases it's lower than that. We've even had negative growth in 2009. Mm-hmm. So when looking at wage income versus non-wage income, what is a better predictor, or how do you segment out those two things with regards to predicting stability in an economy, growth, and is one better than the other?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee, well, better than the other, the wage income growth tends to be more stable, as you can see from the chart. It is not, as my predecessor, Professor Stinson, pointed out many times, it's not as stable as it used to be, because that wage and salary variable includes now more performance-based compensation, like bonuses and stock options. So, you know, assuming that, you know, wage growth is just going to march lockstep with the economy is not as clear as it once was, because it is more even wage growth is more volatile than it used to be. Non-wage income is more volatile because it moves a lot of that is it moves more with the business cycle, and people have a choice as to when they recognize that income. So with regard to forecasting, it's relatively easy. I'm not going to say simple, but it's relatively easier to forecast wage income, because most of that tax is collected through withholding, which is prescribed. The amount of tax that's withheld from your paycheck is prescribed by the tax rate and your number of exemptions. And so we can predict how that's going to move. With regard to forecasting receipts from non-wage income, that's more challenging, because taxpayers have a choice as to when to make those payments and often when to recognize that income. So as more of our receipts are being collected on non-wage income, that it becomes harder to forecast those receipts. I wouldn't want to differentiate as one form of income is good and one form of income is bad. I mean, we need workers earning wages, we need businesses earning profits, and we need people building capital gains and realizing capital gains. It just, the lesson is that when our tax system depends on non-wage income in addition to wage income, then it's going to be, the receipt stream is going to be more volatile, and we need to manage that risk.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, and I appreciate that response, because, you know, one of the things that I'm struggling with as we look at this, and we know from, you know, I'm serving on the tax committee, as many people on this committee do as well, in looking at our system and what are more volatile forms of taxes, and again, our very heavy reliance on the income tax, and that does pose some risks for us with regards to doing our budgeting, predicting our forecast, what's coming in. And so I just think it's pertinent to point this out, because, you know, in looking at this, if wage income is somewhat more predictable and stable, and certainly non-wage income is a factor, but as you pointed out, it's a little less reliable in terms of forecasting because of options due to people. Is it smart to craft budgets with spending that outpaces wage growth when looking to make predictions and forecasts for the future?
Dr. Colum-Petis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, there are a number of different principles or policy goals when you are crafting a tax system. And one of them is volatility, trying to have a relatively stable stream of revenues. Now, volatility of the revenue stream can be managed in other ways. As I said, you can manage the risk in other aspects of the budgeting system. But other principles of tax policy or goals of tax policy are ensuring that you have adequate revenues, ensuring that the tax system does not impose unduly on the economy, and fairness, so distribution of the tax burden across different kinds of people in different parts of the state and different parts of the income distribution. Those principles are always in tension with one another. So in crafting a tax system, you're always balancing those things. So yes, taxes on non-wage income are more volatile. They vary more during the course of time, but they also grow faster, typically. And so there's a balance or a tension right there. So riding a wage when non-wage income goes up is an option, but if you reduce your reliance on non-wage income, you ride that wave, those waves less. So there's less upside potential. There's less downside risk.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick follow-up. I was at your forecast briefing, but I don't recall. For the tails, for 16-17, what are the projections on wage growth for those years? And maybe it's in here.
Dr. Colum-Petis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so to be clear, the forecasts for revenue in the tails are trends. They're extrapolations from trends, and so they do not benefit from our full modeling. So we always have these caveats about the planning estimates that that anything that happens in this biennium is going to affect what happens in the next biennium with regard to our forecast for revenue, but also that we don't do the full degree of modeling for 16 and 17. For wage growth, let's see, wage and salary growth for 2016, we do have forecasts for those variables, even though the income tax, they don't all inform all the income tax forecast. But we have 5.2% growth expected in 2016, or 4.7% in 2017. For personal income, it's 5.2% in 16 and 5.1% in 17. Those are on page 25.
Thank you.
What I'm going to do is we've got, I think, one, two, three, four more people with questions at this point, but I do want to spend some time on the spending side. So I'm going to represent or recognize Representative Nornes. These are all people that have been on the list for a while. Representative Nornes, Gunther, Marquardt, and Lincheski, and then I think we'll have to hear from Assistant Commissioner Kelly. So Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be very, very brief here. In the presentation, I don't recall hearing anything regarding the agricultural sector of Minnesota. Where I come from, that's a pretty important part of our economy. And what I've also heard is that the next couple of years might be a little tough, more difficult than what we've experienced with higher prices and so forth. Has that been taken into effect, and if so, how or where?
Dr. Palamakidis.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, we do we certainly consider the agricultural economy when we're making our forecast, and we do forecast what is going to happen in farm income. Our expectations are that net farm income in 2014, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as you know, has expects that to be net farm income to be down in 2014 from 2013's high levels. So we've had, if you look back over the last 10 years of net farm income and net cash income, which are two different measures, the net cash income is the variable that's more closely allied or more closely related to taxes. But if you look over the last 10 years, the highest 3 years among those 10 years have been the last three in net farm income. And so we do expect net farm income and net cash income to fall, but they're falling off of these really high levels. So we do consider changes in forecast in commodity prices, and we do expect net cash income to decline for 2013 more than net farm income, because it includes the change in inventories that were collected or that were accumulated in 2013. Our year-over-year percent change in farm income as we have it falling in 2013 and falling in 2014 and then holding steady in 2015.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to any of the testifiers. Is there any place we can find out what the gains or losses of businesses from Minnesota? I can't. Department of Trade and Economic Development does not keep track of the losses. They keep track of the gains. Is there any place where we can find out how many businesses have left Minnesota? Department of Revenue, where would we look at that?
Dr. Kalamakidis, is that information that you track?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when you the beginning of your question, I thought you meant business losses and business gains in terms of income, but it sounds like you mean businesses coming and going.
Mr. Chair, Representative, is that a Secretary of State?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Where they'd be registered?
Thank you. I haven't been able to find out what the total is, okay, other than the gains that is kept track of by deed.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think I can add a little bit to that. So the business registrations that are publicized by the Secretary of State should also be accompanied by annual renewals. And so when you see those renewals fall, that those are businesses that are no longer maintaining their registration. And so the Secretary of State's office may be able to help you with that dynamic of how many new businesses are registered and then how many renewals, non-renewals there are.
So we got to check and a recheck then, is that what you're saying? We can check what business increases we had as well as the ones that didn't have renewals. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But not renewing.
Okay, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and this is good news. Thank you. I remember when the state was a few years ago, $6 billion in deficit. It's good to see the state moving in the right direction. And going back to a little bit of the discussion on migration, I think we might need a day, Mr. Chair, to talk about migration studies in here. As Representative Hausman alluded to, in many of the states where there's been increases in income taxes, the data is very inconclusive because, as Representative Hausman mentions people move for a number of reasons, and maybe we need a, I've got a file about 2 inches thick on these migration studies, and the experts will agree it's very inconclusive. Also, you know, talking with folks, when I'm out door knocking, I talk to a number of folks who have moved from a bordering state, which my district lies, for education and other reasons. And I'm going to ask Dr. Kalambukaitis if, in fact, and I know what the answer will be, what has been the increase in population due to the investments in education? I mean, what has been the increase in population with the fact that Minnesota has now set a goal to build the world's best workforce and invested in early childhood, all day, every day, kindergarten? They froze, the state has frozen tuition rates for the next 2 years. So I'm just wondering, Doctor, what's been the increase in the population that's come to Minnesota because of those investments this last year?
Dr. Kalambukaitis?
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, I can refer you again to our expectations for population growth, which are consistent with the state demographers and 0.7% approximately going out. And so it is a net increase in population. I can't say precisely why people have moved to Minnesota. But when asked about Minnesota's current economy and current economic performance, I tend to point to two things, and one is what you alluded to, which is positive workforce factors, a strong workforce, and highly educated workforce. We do have a larger than average percentage of our population with bachelor's degrees. And the other thing that I point to is, and I alluded to this in my comments about the employment increases over the last year, which is the diversity of Minnesota's economy and the broad base of Minnesota's economy. Having employment growth in a wide range of industries can be helpful in attracting people to the state, all other things held equal, because it also improves the resilience of the economy over time, because when one industry is not doing as well, another industry might do well. So those are the things that I tend to point to as making Minnesota attractive.
Thank you. Before I go to Representative Lencheski, if we can work it out, I had earlier in the meeting asked Ms. Conley to see if there is a way we could add the state demographer to our agenda. Because I think a lot of these questions go to that area. When I say see if we can, it would be the availability of the demographer, and then, of course, we have a very fast-paced session going here, so we'll see what we can do in that regard, because I think there are some questions that could probably be responded to by the state demographer. With that, Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all three of you. I know Ms. Kelly hasn't been able to speak yet, but I do want to. And I heard your presentation as well, so I am jumping before the spending part. I do want to ask a little bit on the revenue. Not a specific question, just maybe to think out loud. I was an author of the Budget Trends Study Group, which I know, Dr. Kalambukaitis, you served on, and you know, many of us have heard the presentation of that group many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that group did attempt to take on both the spending and the revenue, and there were Governor Pawlenty's appointees, Senator Pogomiller and Representative Kelleher. A broad group of people from all political walks, and one of the things that was very interesting to me, and something we think about in taxes a lot, and in fact have, you know, the last few years, is the volatility of some of our revenue system. And in Minnesota, it's the capital gains tax and the corporate tax that are the most volatile. And, you know, thankfully the corporate tax isn't, contrary to what people think, it's not a very big part of our revenue stream, but it's very volatile. And the capital gains tax often isn't that big of a piece, but when it starts coming in, it gets quite volatile. And so one of the concerns, you know, I want to spend some time on this year in a different committee is thinking about ways to, in a permanent way, without being political, to address the volatility in the capital gains receipts. And I know we tried to do some timing issues, setting up sort of buckets, reserves to make that be smoother, and that quite didn't work around here politically because it feels like, why are you saving money for something you might not need? Or, you know, because these estimated payments are very, you know, they're difficult to do the forecast with. So I just, you know, I wonder if you can tell me, particularly on the capital gains tax, you know, do you see that, you know, the economy really appears to be surging in Minnesota relative to the nation? And so generally we'd see those capital gains tax start to come in, and then we all start counting on them, and then they go away. Do you have a thought on, you know, how we might address that? And secondly, in this forecast, do you see that as a new and emerging issue if the economy continues to grow?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lunchesky, members of the committee. Well, our wage growth chart illustrates that it's not a new story, the capital gains volatility. That's something that, you know, that's one of the reasons the State Budget Trend Study Commission was created, was because it was something that was a concern, was an issue. And as I mentioned in my response to an earlier question, when you tax non-wage income, in particular capital gains, you get more upside potential and with downside risk. So the alternative, having a more stable revenue system, is that you move away from some of the other principles of tax policy. So if you you don't tax capital gains, or you tax them less, you lose that upside potential and the downside risk. And you also, if you're raising the same amount of revenue on wages, you're going to increase the burden on wages, which is going to have effects across income distribution. So those are some of the tensions that come from trying to make the tax system less volatile. And one of the things that came out of that study, because of nice work that Professor Stinson and Matt Shepner in our office did, was to look at those trade-offs, the trade-off between revenue volatility and the other principles, for instance, the distribution of the tax burden and the potential for revenue gain. And so so the commission came down on managing that risk rather than making dramatic changes to the tax system. I'm sure you know the report well, but that was the sort of the bottom line, was that you can make changes to the tax system, but you're going to have these other consequences that you'll want to consider on other aspects of the tax system, including the distribution of the burden and the potential for revenue gain. So another thing that came out of that study was the fact that MMB now does regularly analyzes that volatility and makes recommendations for reserves. And it makes sense logically that your recommendation for reserves would change with revenue volatility. So a more volatile stream, you need larger reserves. A larger budget, you need larger reserves. And so I think the discussion about changing the tax system goes hand in hand with options for managing that volatility. So if you're going to keep the income streams the same, manage the volatility of the revenue stream differently. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can add on as a coda. For those who aren't familiar with the report that Dr. Kalambakidis was just mentioning, it is on our website. It is an annual event, basically, where we provide information about the volatility. And one of the ways that you can manage that is basically through what kind of level of reserves and what kind of assurance you can get, or confidence interval you can get from that.
Okay, I indicated that we'd spend the last few minutes then. Assistant Commissioner Kelly, if you could go to the spending side of the forecast for us. Thank you.
Certainly. On the spending side, you can see we now have a $39.019 billion budget for the 14-15 biennium, and this is just a $48 million change from our November estimates. So it's important to keep in mind that our budget continues to grow on the spending side year over year, biennium to biennium, and in this forecast we are simply lowering that growth slightly by just a tenth of a percent. K-12 education spending is lowered by $29 million in this forecast, just two-tenths of a percent. We are continuing to see increased growth in pupil counts. And there's a nice chart on page 58 of the document which shows the growth that we are forecasting in this biennium and the next biennium in pupil growth, and just the slight increase that we are making to that. And that growth in pupil counts is offset by two things. One, a reduced growth rate in the number of students living in poverty. And this poverty rate drives a couple of formulas, but primarily the compensatory aid formula. So that's been lowered by $12 million in this forecast. Second, the spending for the recently enacted Achievement and Integration Aid Program is the actual spending is lower than expected, and so we have lowered our spending in this forecast by $9 million for the current biennium only. Property tax aids and credits, spending is down. We've lowered our spending estimates by $24 million. We're still anticipating growth in this area, however. But the participation in homeowner and renter refund programs is down. And like in November, we saw this in November as well, income growth seems to be outpacing growth in property tax liabilities. And that's driving our spending growth down. Health and Human Services spending is up slightly, only $16 million increase compared to November. This is really a relatively small change for such a large portion of our general fund spending. There's a lot going on in this area, upwards and downwards. There is an increase in spending by $50 million out of the general fund, a transfer to the Health Care Access Fund, a transfer in law that is triggered for the first time based on a certification by the Department of Health on overall health care savings and the extent to which that has been shared by state-run programs. In addition to that, the governor exercised his authority in law to delay the nursing facility level of care changes by 1 year. This is a law that's been on the books for quite some time. We were seeking federal waiver, and the governor chose to delay the implementation of that by 1 year, which increased our cost by $8 million. These additional small increases in MA spending and these other two I just mentioned were offset by savings from lowered payment rates for basic care for individuals with disabilities. We've reduced this line in the budget by $56 million. All other spending has been reduced by $12 million, and this is primarily due to the sale of the bonds for the Vikings Stadium that lowered our debt service cost by $6 million. It was both a good day to go to market, and we had a lower rate than we anticipated for that bond sale. And we were able to sell more bonds than we had anticipated as tax-exempt bonds as opposed to taxable bonds. So moving on to the next biennium, our budget outlook for the 16-17 biennium is improving as well. A $303 million improvement in the longer-term revenue projections, as well as $98 million reduction in our spending estimates, result in a $401 million increase in the balance for the by the end of the next biennium. So we're now projecting a $2.599 billion of structural balance for the next biennium, which is a good position to be in for the state. First time we've seen a positive balance both in the current biennium and the next biennium in quite some time. That's all I have for spending.
So, Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation. I think, as we started out, that this is a good piece of information because there's, I think, some confirming factors to some of the assumptions that we had in November, that the situation's gotten somewhat better. The challenge, though, still remains that this is there's always risks, there's always volatility, and taking this good news can also lead us into places where we don't want to go. Last couple of times we had similar budget outlooks. We realized all too late that we're closer to a recession than we realized, and that is always the thing that's hard to anticipate. In fact, on average, we're probably closer to the next recession than we are from the last one. So those are the usual somber tones that we want to leave you with on this presentation. Happy to take any additional questions you might have.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Thanks. Actually, just a question for the chair, I think. Healthcare Access Fund isn't usually part of the forecast, but it's a really important fund, and it's going to be a big deficit. Do you plan to talk about that in a meeting sometime?
I'm assuming I would need to see if you're Representative Huntley. I've had some informal discussions with Representative Huntley on it. I'm a little not sure whether this will be the format or whether it will be in the committee you serve on with Representative Huntley.
Yeah. Well, just thought, Mr. Chair, there's a large deficit which will affect potentially general fund burdens. So it might be worthwhile for people to get the speed on that so they know what's coming. So that's my suggestion. Thank you.
And that's included in the forecast, if I recall correctly from our earlier.
Mr. Chair, that is.
Or no, that's not outside because it's not general fund. That's
but it is posted on our website, Mr. Chair.
But it is, okay. I thought there was something that, and we've also had conversations with the department as well. Before we break, then we will be getting together 1 hour. And by the way, thank the three of you. I'm just going to make a couple of quick announcements. We'll meet 1 hour after we adjourn, and then tomorrow at 11:40 we're going to convene, and we have a very short period of time, about 35 minutes if everybody arrives on time. We'll be taking up the House budget resolution, and I have talked to the lead and some other members, but it's going to be a budget resolution that at this point touches on just three areas. We will be dealing with the tax bill tomorrow at 11:40. We'll be dealing with the issue of the dumped lunches in our schools. Some of you maybe have been following that. We're 40 school districts that have been dumping the lunches if children on the reduced lunch can't afford it. That will be in the budget resolution so that legislation can move forward. And the other one, then, we have to account for the relief we had with the heating bill, the $20 million the other day. So we'll be taking up the balance of the accounts that we deal with a future budget resolution, but we are going to cover those three. I just want to remind people we're on a very fast track. We came into session late, and meaning later in the spring or the winter than we normally do. And one of the reasons that we're taking up the tax bill this afternoon, and we took it out of the or passed it up to the tax committee. Can I use the word passed these days with the negotiations? It was referred out of the tax committee to us.
That's
the way
I guess. I'm staying out of that one.
You're going to stay out of that one. I proliferally got involved with that one too. So we'll make sure we follow the regular procedures. The reason that it's necessary to move as we are is that I think in tax committee, Representative Lincheski can correct me on this, wasn't it 29% of the people have filed already and people are continuing to file? So the sooner we get some of these tax issues resolved, the better it will be for Minnesota residents. So we'll see you 1 hour after the session, and then again tomorrow morning at 11:40 when we take up the budget resolution. With that, meeting adjourned. Art. I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee, and we'll be taking up House File 1777 by Representative Lincheski. Representative Lincheski, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess I would take your counsel on is the motion to the floor. I'd like to move House File 1777 as amended to the floor. Is that correct?
Okay, that's right. That's close enough. Okay, and if you want to, that motion is before us, so the bill is before us. If you'd like to present the bill.
Mr. Mayor, I was at a city council meeting. I'm an old city council member. Mr. Chair, if I may, can I add the A11 first to get it in order? I'd like it.
Okay.
So I would move the A11 if that's all right. It's technical, and it reduces slightly the administrative cost that was added in tax committee that you and I and Representative Davids talked about, that there might be an adjustment. It's an adjustment downward.
Okay, and that puts the bill in the order that you'd like to present it. So the motion that we adopt, the A11 amendment, is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll just very quickly, I think most of us are fairly familiar with the bill, just talk about House File 1777 as amended just a little bit. I do want to first thank Representative Davids and all the members of the Tax Committee who've been working very hard last week to get this bill before us here now. And so for the public, I'll just briefly mention federal conformity and the repeal of three business-to-business taxes that were put into law last year is what this bill is about. It's a little over $500 million in middle-class tax cuts. So what's really going on here, there's two big pieces in the bill, and they have a lot of detail within them, but the way to think about it is when the Congress passes tax relief for Americans, states conform or don't conform to pass on those tax benefits to their citizens and to make the tax system less complicated for filers. And so what we're trying to do in this bill is conform to the majority of items for the current filing tax year we're in right now, 2013, and that's why we're trying to work to get this done as quickly as possible. Not every single provision, but the overwhelming majority. And then also provide those tax relief items going forward on a permanent basis, with a few exceptions where Congress has not allowed that tax benefit going forward. So I'll just quickly mention a few of them in what's in the bill. There is $111 million for middle-income married filers in tax relief. 650,000 Minnesota families will receive an average tax cut of $115. And I would note the vast majority of families that claim the standard deduction make less than $75,000. There's $36 million of tax relief for low-income working families. This boosts the working family credit to match the federal earned income tax credit. More than 50,000 working families will see an average tax cut of $300. $26.4 million of tax cuts for students and parents paying for college and students paying off loans. These are different education-related provisions including the qualified tuition and related expenses. There's $7.2 million for homeowners who either refinanced, foreclosed, or had a short sale, and I know a lot of members have heard about that from folks who were surprised to learn that because Minnesota didn't conform last year after people went through foreclosure and thought they had been forgiven the debt, that in fact they found out they were supposed to pay taxes on that, and so we're correcting that now. Additionally, there's $3.9 million in tax cuts for new homeowners. This is conforming on the mortgage insurance premium deduction. $1.8 million in tax cuts for Minnesota families with dependents. 26,000 families with household incomes below $38,570 will see an $80 tax cut. There's $400,000 in tax cuts for folks who are adopting children. These are employer-provided adoption assistance exclusion that we're conforming to. $1.1 million in tax cuts for 60,000 teachers. These are classroom expense deductions for educators. $6.7 million in tax cuts for businesses to make tax filing simpler. And $4 million in tax cuts to incentivize charitable contributions. Those are kind of the highlights on the federal conformity piece. And then the B2B taxes, we're familiar. Two of them are underway. That's the equipment tax at the business-to-business level. A lot of people call it the farm equipment repair tax, but it's not just farm equipment. It's all the equipment repair. And so we would end that tax and have refunds for those folks. Then there's the warehouse tax, which has not started. It's supposed to go into effect on April 1st, and we're trying to repeal that so that doesn't happen. And the other one is the telecom, and the tax committee worked together in a nice fashion to think through how we might, rather than retroactively, as we end the tax, do refunds. Instead, we use those resources to build out the networks. I think we're going to continue to have ongoing conversations that will really take place in Chair Johnson's committee about how that's done, but I think it's a fair characterization to say that it's more likely that money will go more outstate than metro, and I think we as a committee can't speak for everyone, but I think we thought that was fair, given that most folks in the metro have a pretty good telecom system, and it's really we're missing coverage for a lot of people in outstate Minnesota. So we'd be looking to Representative Johnson's committee and those members to figure out how that those resources would be used. So I think that that covers it, and I'm available for questions.
Okay, any discussion? Well, seeing none then, Representative Lincheski renews her motion that House File 1777, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. And with that, remember, tomorrow we meet at 11:40 in this room, and we'll be taking up the budget resolution at 11:40. Meeting adjourned.